Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Robert Lustig, a pediatric endocrinologist who has spent the last 20 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF's Children's Hospital and a member of UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And he's also featured in the new documentary, Fed Up. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Robert Lustig.
Oh, thank you very much for having me again, Ian.
And you were also on Bill Maher the other night. So it seems to me we've spoken over the years and you've been working to try and raise the public's consciousness about sugar, which you consider a toxin, and you deal with the effects of sugar in terms of childhood obesity on a daily basis. Is the word slowly getting out, do you think?
Well, first of all, let me correct you just real briefly, Ian. It's not just sugar. There are actually eight separate things wrong with the American diet. Three things too little, five things too much. Quickly, the three things too little fiber, too little micronutrients, too little omega-3 fatty acids. Now the five things too much, too little branched chain amino acids, too much trans fats, too much omega-6 fatty acids, too much alcohol, and finally, too much sugar. Now, of those eight, sugar is the marker for processed food because 77% of all the foods in America now have added sugar. And sugar is the one that the food industry specifically uses to get you to buy more. And sugar is the one we have the most data about. So really what this is it's a processed food problem, not just a sugar problem. But, of course, the media likes to focus on sugar because, number one, everyone loves it. Number two, it's sexy. Number three, it's highly inflammatory. And number four, the sugar industry is acting like the tobacco industry. So there's a lot of reasons to focus on it, and that's fine. But I want people to understand this is a processed food issue. It's much bigger than just sugar alone.
But when you count one of the eight as alcohol, isn't alcohol also sugar?
Well, it's processed in cells very similar to the way sugar is. And in fact, that's why children who don't consume alcohol are getting alcohol-related diseases, such as fatty liver disease, diabetes, and heart disease, because sugar is the alcohol of the child. And that is how I got into this business in the first place, and that's why we need policies that will actually protect our children, because right now they are going to live a shorter lifespan than their parents, and they're going to cost the healthcare system unbelievably large sums of money going forward from here if we don't fix the problem.
Well, it seems like in other countries, though, they're moving towards sugar taxes on soft drinks.
Mexico just did.
Mexico, exactly.
That's right.
So, and presumably the monies raised can be used in both creating awareness of these health risks of consuming sugars, etc. What's the sense? I mean, I know the beverage industry is a pretty powerful lobby here in the United States.
They certainly are. And it's not just beverages. I mean, it's all of the, you know, processed food industry. What you've seen thus far is numerous municipalities that have raised the specter of sugar taxes of various sorts, and the processed food industry has gone in and defeated every single one of them. As I think you're probably aware, San Francisco will be floating a soda tax on the ballot in November of this year. And one of the differences in that ballot is that the money is going to be plowed back into the areas where it came from in the lower socioeconomic strata, very specifically for obesity prevention, farmers markets, rec and health, expenditures, rather than just contributing to general coffers. And here in San Francisco, people are relatively, you know, meaning and wealth. You know, they think about what they're doing, and so hopefully we will see a little bit of a backlash against the food industry here in San Francisco come November.
Now, in terms of the culpability of the U.S. government, particularly the Agricultural Department, who of course oversee food stamps, my understanding is that poor people, and unfortunately there are many more poor people now because we're in a sort of new gilded age where there's tremendous income inequality, a growing underclass, and as you know, this is the arguments in Washington over extending food stamp and cutting benefits has become quite intense, and the amount of money spent on food stamps has gone up exponentially. And the problem, my understanding, is that so many of these recipients of food stamps are single mothers trying to spread a limited budget to keep their kids fed. And unfortunately, you know, processed food, sugary foods, give the illusion of nutrition. So, how can you can't blame these people, but you have to figure a way to work with these people. And what's the government doing about that? They sound like they're more in complicity than they are in terms of educating people.
Well, indeed, this is a major problem. Let's focus back on something you just said. Is sugar nutrition? Yes or no? I would argue that it's not. There is not one biochemical reaction that requires dietary sugar. In fact, sugar causes all of these chronic metabolic diseases that are going up in the population, such as type 2 diabetes, lipid problems, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, polycystic ovarian disease, and many others. And there's no requirement for it. Yes, there is no question that sugar is an energy source, but is it nutrition? Do you need it? Is it required? Well, let's think of another energy source that's not needed. Alcohol. Now, would you call alcohol nutrition? Of course not. Alcohol is a toxin. Well, sugar is a toxin for the same reasons alcohol is. We have a threshold for metabolism. There is a threshold under which it can be perfectly safe and not cause problems. But once you go over that threshold, you start getting sick and you start costing yourself and other people money. And that's what we have with sugar. The American Heart Association says we should be consuming 6 to 9 teaspoons of added sugar per day or less. We are currently at 22 teaspoons of added sugar per day. And it's not necessarily because we go out and seek it, but because one half of the added sugar that we consume is in foods we didn't even know had it, like tomato sauce, barbecue sauce, hamburger buns, hamburger meat for that matter. There's an enormous sugar glut, which is causing disease and driving obesity and all of these chronic metabolic diseases, and it's not even nutrition. So should the government be spending so much money subsidizing a substance that is not even nutrition? This is a major question, and it's actually a question that led to the development of our nonprofit called the Institute for Responsible Nutrition, because sugar is not responsible nutrition.
So is there, I mean, the FDA have, of course, have these labels on food, which are wholly inadequate.
Of course. But
where do you stand in terms of getting the government to do the right thing?
Well, the government has to do the right thing because the food industry certainly won't. In fact, the food industry is acting just like the tobacco industry did several years ago, and in fact, they're the same people, after all, because Altria is Philip Morris, who owned Kraft and General Foods, and RJR is Nabisco. They are actually the same people, and in fact, we have data that shows there are very specific people that have worked for both tobacco and the food industry. So, you know, we know what we're dealing with. The problem, of course, is that no one needs tobacco, and tobacco serves no function, not even as an energy source. Whereas with sugar, you're talking about something that at least could be consumed with a certain safe threshold. And the food industry will tell you that in moderation, sugar is no problem whatsoever. And you know what? I even agree with that. The problem is, what is moderation? They won't define it. And the reason they won't define it is because they won't tell you what the upper limit is. And you know that that's true because all you have to do is go look at the side of a package, and wherever it says sugar on the nutrition facts label, there's no number, there's no percentage, there's no dietary reference intake, there's no percent daily value, there's no upper limit, and they don't, because they don't want you to know how much is too much. Because if you knew how much was too much, breakfast cereal would disappear from the planet. in a nanosecond.
Well, the mayor of New York, though, did at least tried to limit the amount of soda, sugary soda.
Right. He did. He tried.
And he got labeled as a sort of nanny. As, you know, that seems to be the buzzword that that's used, the idea that this is an imposition on our freedom.
Right. Let's go there. This is all about this notion of personal responsibility, isn't it? So, first of all, where did personal responsibility come from? Where did this notion of personal responsibility come from? Is it ingrained in our Constitution? Was it around at the Declaration of Independence? Absolutely not. In fact, personal responsibility was invented by the tobacco industry in 1960 when they were getting hammered by the science that was coming out of labs all and physicians all over the country. And they said, well, you get a choice. You know, it's a personal responsibility choice as to whether you smoke or not. Well, that was before we understood about the role of nicotine in addiction. Well, sugar's addictive as well, weakly so, but addictive nonetheless. So you know as well as I do that education alone has not solved any substance of abuse, not tobacco, not alcohol, not street drugs, and it's not going to solve sugar. So this notion of personal responsibility is extraordinarily misplaced, and it is, in fact, it was an invention of the tobacco industry. Second, personal responsibility has four caveats, four things, criteria you have to meet before you can actually declare it personal responsibility. One, knowledge. You have to have knowledge. The five-year-old who shoots his brother with a loaded gun is not guilty because he didn't have the knowledge it was loaded and what it would do. Access. We've just thrown 57,000 people off the voting rolls here in the United States due to redistricting. They don't have access. How can they exercise their personal responsibility to vote? Three, affordability. You have to be able to afford your choice, and society has to be able to afford your choice. Well, right now, employers have to pay $2,750 per employee for obesity, whether the employee is obese or not, and it is dragging down the economy. And then finally, the last one, your choice can't hurt anyone else. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you consume sugar-containing beverages, get cardiovascular disease and or diabetes, and clog up the emergency room so that I have to pay for it, you are hurting me. So personal responsibility in terms of sugar consumption and obesity fails on all four criteria. I would argue that personal responsibility is completely a misguided issue in this current food debacle.
So, Dr. Robert Lustig, then, you've made the case that not only are there analogies with the current debate over sugar and additives in food and processed food and its links to tobacco and the extent to which, in fact, even companies that used to be in the tobacco industry and still are also in the food industry, and the same lobbyists are at play, those that delayed for decades the need to ban smoking or alert people to the dangers of smoking, and short of banning the product outright.
We tried to ban it outright, and Congress actually stopped us from doing so.
Right.
It was a congressional determination of the 2000 Family Tobacco Control Act that said you can't get rid of it.
But essentially, at least some progress was made, and now we're trying to apply the same to additives in food, in particular sugar and high fructose corn syrup. So the question now is, because you've made the connection to tobacco, nicotine is clearly addictive. Is sugar addictive?
It is weakly so. It is not as addictive as nicotine. There are studies that suggest that it is more addictive than cocaine. I happen to not agree with that. I don't think it's more addictive than cocaine. I think it's less addictive. But nonetheless, it is weakly addictive. The problem is that if you're addicted to a substance, the only way to deal with it is to go cold turkey and get off it. How do you go cold turkey off sugar when it's in everything? And that's on purpose. It's in everything because the food industry knows when they add it, you buy more. It keeps that addiction going. And that's one of the reasons why we have such recidivism in terms of weight loss in the population. And no one seems to be able to lose weight. And everyone seems to just get sicker and sicker. And the type 2 diabetes is going through the roof. And we're seeing type 2 diabetes in children, unheard of 30 years ago. Now, 57,000 type 2 diabetic adolescents. This is unconscionable.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Robert Lustig.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, who's a pediatric endocrinologist who has spent the last 20 years treating childhood obesity and studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, metabolism, and disease. He's the director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF's Children's Hospital, a member of the UCSF Institute for Health Policy Studies, and a member of the Obesity Task Force of both the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. His latest book is Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, and he is featured in the new documentary, Fed Up. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the similarities between the food industry and the tobacco industry, many of whom are the same players.